introduction to our with Dmitry inversion code. So I'll just mention some essential part and then present two synthetic models. One is self-cropping conductive data and another one Komeni model to adjacent blocks and then some conclusions. So usually the 3D inversion is solved by finding a stationary point over a penalty functional phi, is it? So this function consists of two parts, dating speed phi z and the relaxation part phi s. And I think most of the people here do inversion in this way. So the different codes could be different. I found these five points where the inversion codes could be different. First of all, what are the model parameters? So it can be conductivity, resistivity, some log resistivity or conductivity, some function of the conductivity and resistivity. The second point is what the forward solver is used for the inversion, as an engine for the inversion. Like yesterday, a lot of codes were presented, so finite difference, finite elements, integral equation. Then what optimization methods is used to find this stationary point? Gauss-Newton, quasi-Newton, limited memory, quasi-Newton, and LCG, etc. A lot of different optimization methods, or some combination of the methods as well could be used. Another point is, what is our data? Is it the apparent resistivity and phase, impedance tensor, some entrances of impedance tensor? And even if we know what our data is, what the exact form of the penalty functional of the dating speed people are going to use? And the last one is this, because inversion is solution is not unique, what regularization of the stabilizer phi s we are going to use in our inversion. So in our code, we call it x3d e. I at the end.
X3d
i.
Oh, x3d
e. And so the model parameters are conductivities. And we also use the constraints optimization, so optimization with simple bounds, so we impose some bounds on the conductivities. That's about the model parameters in our code. So forward solver is x3de, the integral equation code was presented yesterday, the basic equations were presented yesterday by Dmitry. And we use this code for the inversion and usually also for generating the synthetic data. And as for optimization, we use limited memory quasi-Newton method. All the optimization methods work, iterative methods work in similar manner. So first we find the search direction vector p here, then we move along this search direction by some step alpha. And then when we moved along this search direction and found the sufficient decrease along this direction, we update our model parameters as following. I think most people do the same. The only difference between different methods, how we find this search direction vector p. So in our inversion, we use limited memory quasi-Newton methods. And for this method, the search direction is found with use of some number ncp, which can be 3 or 4 or 5 or 6 correction pairs. So it's pairs of vectors. One is just vector of model parameters, and another one of the gradient and we just have to store NCP pairs of vectors to find the search direction, which is usually only another method which doesn't need to store a lot of vectors is NLC3, but all others, Newton, Gauss-Newton and Quasi-Newton, they have to store much more information. So that's about optimization method. So our data misfit. So we invert for all eight entries of the impedance tensor, and our penalty function looks like this, where this matrix A is the difference between predicted and observed impedance tensor. So those are 2x2 complex valued matrices, and so the beta are just some positive weights. If somebody has any questions during the presentation, it's very good if they ask immediately. Okay.
I didn't know if you were going to get back to it or not, but I'm just curious why you invert for conductivity, not log of conductivity.
I'm not exactly sure that it's the good thing we are doing, but the idea was that if we have the boundaries on the conductivities, if we use log these boundaries inside, then our boundaries go to infinity. And the idea was that if our solution is somewhere close to these boundaries, then we have to jump to this infinity, and it might slow down the solution, but maybe it's not true. Does it make sense?
No, I understand. I understand what you're saying. When you impose bounds, you get close to the boundaries, you may get stuck or something, but maybe that's, two things. Maybe that's where you're supposed to be, but you can always, come back just a little bit. You don't have to, if you get to the boundary, you can always come back just a little bit. I don't know what the answer is. I just think that I just like logs because I would think that the inversion, when you use logarithmic parameterization, I would think that since resistivity can span so many orders of magnitude, that it would be better. But I've never tried this approach you do, so I don't know if you have you tried log sigma versus sigma.
No.
But we would like
to try. Maybe it's better.
I'm curious. I don't know.
Maybe it will actually.
You can put bounds on. You can. Anyway, I'll let them know.
Do you like it because it increases the dynamic range?
I like it because it because resistivity. Why use it? Well, I've always used it for a couple reasons. One, if you don't use bounds, it keeps the conductivity or resistivity positive, and because resistivity in a model can go over so many orders of magnitude, I just find that the inversion proceeds a lot more smoothly and quickly to an answer. Now, if you put bounds, though, that's a whole other.
I also read somewhere in your paper, I think, that you like it because you don't care in this case what to use, resistivity or conductivity.
Right. There was a paper by Torkel Smith who looked at, in 1D, who looked at inverting for conductivity, resistivity, log, or whatever, and found that depending on what you inverted for, your misfits had a certain, either skewed towards low frequencies or high frequencies. And I think he said that log.
Well, that was more on the recognition. Are you doing the sigma dz or d log sigma d log
did anybody try to compare Locke against without Locke?
Yeah, Tom Smith became
for TV.
For TV.
Yeah,
yeah,
we did that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Coded ours so that we could either work with log or work with conductivity. And one of the places that I thought we were going to achieve some major benefit is when we have very large high conductivity contrast. We're doing some stuff in Sudbury where the conductivity is 10 to the 5th and the background is 10 to the minus 6, which is, first of all, difficult to model. But secondly, when you're working with the inversion and then you're starting and you're working with the logs, then you tend to think about a significant change in the model as being, you know, like maybe a factor of 2 or something like this. And that means that if you're starting with a background of 10 to the minus 6, it really is taking you a long time to go anywhere, plus the fact that you don't really have, you know, very much sensitivity. So if you work with conductivities in cases like that, since the equations are really built in conductivity, you find that you can dump in a fair bit of conductivity quite readily earlier on in the immersion. So I think there's a place that it potentially helps. Other than that, most of the cases that we've done, it's sort of almost like 6 in one hand, half dozen in the other, and we definitely prefer to use logs for the exact reasons that you said. Because most times in practical interpretations of conductivity, it really is the relative conductivity that's the most important thing. Whether you're biased up a factor of 10 or not, you're looking for a resistor compared to a conductor, and that's where the log helps you.
Well, you're predominantly, in 3D, you're looking predominantly at charge distribution. And so you are looking at the difference between the conductivities on either side of the boundary. You can stress that it's logged.
So as I mentioned before, we have to store some pairs of vectors, and one of these vectors is the gradient of our penalty function. So to calculate the gradient, we use a joint approach, and here is some formula for this for one of the derivatives. The main point on this slide is that we have to solve two systems of Maxwell's equations. So one is just our normal system we use in MT, and another one is very similar. The only differences here, this sources on the right hand side of this equation, those are just the a combination of electric and magnetic dipoles, which are located at the MT site. So for to calculate the gradients, we actually have to solve just two forward problems. And I think, we use Tikhonov-type stabilizer, and in our implementation, it's just a finite different approximation to the Laplace operator. So now I move on to the model examples, model studies. So the first one is the outcropping conductive dike. So those are 7 horizontal slices through the model, starting from the top, so from the surface to the bottom, 700 meters. So each dike is is it? No, 200. No. It's 3 ohm meter conductive dike inside the 100 ohm meter half space, but I'm just curious about dimensions. I forgot. 200 by 800 meters.
Scale.
Yeah.
Scale is about 10.
It doesn't matter.
It doesn't matter.
Something about 800 by 200.
Yeah, I think it's 800 by 200 at the depth of which dike is 100 meters.
So that's the model. Everybody understands what's presented on this slide. Okay. And for this model, we calculated the data for 42 empty sites located on the surface for four periods from 1 to 1,000 hertz, and we calculated the data using the X3D code and added 1% noise to this data. And he also on this slide presented the reading for inversion and modeling domains, which were a bit different. So the inversion domain is a little smaller, and it comprised of about 3,000 cells, and modeling domain is a bit larger than inversion. So for this data, we got the following results. So the second row key is the result of the inversion. I think it's a reasonable result.
you have your constraints on here, or is this?
Yes, there are constraints which are reasonable constraints. I think from what is it? From 1 to 10,000.
1 to 10,000, and then this is a result after how many iterations?
So this the convergence occurred here. So that's the number of the function and gradient evaluations here on the x-axis. So it was about 550 quasi-Newton iterations.
Was there any noise added to this data? Did you add noise?
1% noise.
So I forgot. You told this data. I mean, so what's your boundary condition on the base of the modeling?
They're changing data. So I'm not sure what is it now. It's just free?
No, what are you asking for?
You have a condition on your base of your modeling domain, right?
Yeah, yeah. It's just free, yeah.
So you're not looking for a uniform field. Uniform field on the base.
I understood that you're asking about
boundary
condition for regularization part, right?
No, for the modeling domain. This is because your modeling domain is separate. It was exactly the same number of layers as you.
No. More layers than a modeling.
No, if you back up, it's I thought it's
yeah.
Seven. Yeah.
You see?
Yeah, you've got seven layers in your.
More.
They're n
modeling. Next.
No, the modeling domain. No, it's maybe wrong here. It's
oh,
just half space.
Oh, half space?
Yes.
You have no boundary condition on the film. At all.
Yeah.
You have no problem like boundary condition problems. You have a lot of other problems.
All entries of the impedance tensor. So the data misfit is this, where this matrix A is the difference between the observed and predicted impedance. So they all inside all eight.
So what is the beta?
Beta is some positive weights which were one divided by number of sites, number of frequencies, and by 0.05, I think. 5%. Yeah.
To generate related error. It is a related error. So beta. So in numerator you have square root of impedance matrix, right? And in denominator you have square impedance observed impedance.
Yeah.
So it's so for each site and for each period, it is a relative error.
Yes,
it is not a nice problem.
you give us the data together with errors, we would be able to put it in the
program.
Inside, yeah. But because we don't have any idea about errors, so it's just like this.
Yeah. But I read that expressed yesterday, I think, about some cutoff noise floor, that if your impedance is below this floor, you should substitute real impedance by this floor.
Yeah.
It's a good idea, so, but this is not implemented.
Sum of the squares of the
absolute
values of the differences.
Some contribution
we have the weighting for every entrance of the impedance tensor, but just it wasn't implemented yet.
But actually what you're doing, I understand now, Sophie, actually what you're doing is some kind of error flow. It's some kind of effective error flow, 5% that you're using. I think that's it.
Yeah, that's right.
Effective.
5% on the max.
On the whole thing. On the whole thing. Yeah. There's nothing wrong with it.
Except that 5% on impedance is 10% on resistivity.
Okay.
Yeah,
degrees,
but
that's
Alan, that's just a number, 5%.
Okay.
You can put anything there. You can, because it's 5% for all of them, you can take it out of
yeah,
the
no.
sum.
In the real world.
You just when Anna present our final result, maybe you will be not so positive.
Anyway, that's the result of the first, no, that was second model we tried, and we got quite excited because we got the position of the drive correctly and the resistivity value is quite right. But then we tried, that we looked on the convergence curve, so every NFJ takes 10 minutes. NFJ is the number of function and gradient evaluations. 4 days? 4 days, I think.
4 days?
Yeah.
Yeah, but that was on a laptop, you know, it wasn't on a Greg Moon.
No. That's just picture to show you, like, if you use one frequency, the result is much worse. So that's the vertical slice through the middle of the model. So the number of frequencies helps to improve the result, which is should be like this. So the next model is two adjacent blocks. That's a COMMU model. So we have two-layered background. Where is it? So 10 ohmmeters and 100 ohmmeters, and then two blocks of 1 ohmmeter and 100 ohmmeters inside the background. So these blocks have the thickness of 10 kilometers. So that was our inversion and modeling domain.
Probably you should thank Virachai for proposing
for
us.
Yeah. So
we this model.
Yeah.
We worked 1 year over one model.
So yeah, Virachai insisted that we should get the proper result for this model. So. And we couldn't get any results in the beginning at all. So first, like, if you put the sites in every single cell of the inversion domain, which is a huge amount of MT sites, it's 400 sites, and then again, you calculate the data for three frequencies, add 1% noise to this data, that's the result you obtain, which is a good result. You get the interface right here. So the only thing I don't like here is this resistive artifact around the conductive anomalies, but they are on the boundary of the conductive anomaly. Probably it's maybe even unavoidable to get some resistive artifact there.
Well, your regularization function kind of spreads things out there too. So.
Mm.
Yeah, but it's increasing
gradient. That's right at the surface too?
Yeah.
Oh, that's right at the surface.
Yeah.
So you probably have a big misfit here too. Did you look at the
residuals?
Look at the residuals right at the surface. I bet those sites aren't well fit for whatever.
Yeah, possible. But anyway, this result is not too bad, but if you remember, we put sites in every single cell of the inversion domain. That's the vertical slice through the middle of the model, so you can see the anomaly spreads down a little bit, but it's normal for NT. But I think the result is good, and again, the convergence curve P is 7 minutes per one gradient and function of variation.
Sorry, what were the frequencies again?
There were three frequencies of from 100 seconds to 1,000.
Okay.
But if we put sites not everywhere, so those are just 80 randomly distributed empty sites on the surface, and again calculate the data for the same three frequencies and add 1% noise to this data, that's the result we got. And this result is not good at all. So we can see a lot of resistive artifacts around the location of empty sites. Here, I want to
say
show.
Ray should know about
embedded results. Yes, I'm sure. So if you overimpose the location of empty sites on the first layer of the result, that's okay. You can see that we get reasonable values of the resistivity just beneath the empty sites. And around, you get all these horrible resistors. And we try different regularization parameters and different regularizations like gradient and Laplacian, and nothing helped to improve this. So our conclusion was that we need some additional constraints, not just Tikhonov type stabilizer. Yeah? That's 50.
50.
So that's the initial model because.
And how did you conclude that your regularization was enough? I mean, was it you just increased the regularization parameter?
I tried.
At all?
It helped a little bit, but it didn't.
But I mean, then something is strange because I mean, if you put it up high enough, it should just give you, it should smooth everything out.
If you put it too high, you cannot do even one iteration because it's high, and then you want to.
Yeah, but you should be able to increase, and it should make it smoother. Does that happen?
It makes it smoother, but not smooth enough.
Well,
but
increases more. Does it make it smoother?
If I increase it too much, I cannot do even one iteration because.
You can't do one iteration.
Because I'm trying to move along some direction, and when I move even a little bit along this direction, my regularization part multiplied by regularization parameter is so high that it's much higher than the initial one. So, but we try to decrease our penalty function every single iteration, so it's not allowed to increase it.
But this is not final result.
Yeah.
We have much better. Wait, maybe, but okay.
No
but the first iteration, we just go basically our surface direction is just minus gradient. So there is
no.
Yes. So there is no regularization in the first step at all, and then so this gradient is not smooth at all. So that's basically that's how it looks like. So we move along this gradient, and it's very erratic model. And this erratic model, if regularization.
Why not move along the precondition gradient?
That's what I'm going.
Sorry.
But this is the main problem for quasi-Newton, I think. Approach. You see, because you start from minus g.
Well, it's the same thing. It's the same thing with anything. You know.
So you need to do something with this gradient. So we call it additional constraints.
Okay.
So we tried different things, and the simplest and the one which helped was just a simple Gaussian filter on the gradient or on your model parameters. So now we are looking for the point for solution in different model space, this cylinder here. So those are just some smooth conductivities. So those are old ones, and that's new ones, and that's Gaussian filter. And that's the explicit form for the filter we use. So it's just horizontal in X and Y direction. There is nothing in Z. And if we use this filter, that's the result we get. So the second row here. For the same 80 sites and for three frequencies and for 1% noise data. So I think the result is quite good. So the third round. Again, we started here with 50 ohmmeter half space.
So you're just filtering the gradient each step?
I'm filtering the gradient each step.
Just killing off the large entries in the surface. Can you put killing them off?
Yeah.
Deflating them and down.
But actually in every layer.
No. Sorry.
In every layer. Yes. Yeah. Everywhere, but maybe it's not right to do.
But what I was going to suggest is something similar, but it's sort of similar to what Greg and I do in the NLCG, is you precondition, you go in the direction of the precondition. you can just use the inverse of your L transpose L plus a little damping, because that's got a null space, and that's easy to solve.
Yeah. What we tried, we calculated the Hessian matrix.
No, forget about that. But you could just do like your L transpose L plus some damping inverse, because that's a smooth. That's very similar to what you've done here, because that's a filtering thing as well.
So just the Hessian of the regularization part.
But that's related exactly. That's related to the regularization that you're actually applying. This is something to try.
So you forget about the data misfit part for the preconditioning and just use the Hessian, the inverse of the Hessian for the regularization part.
Right, but you got to add a little damping because that's got a null space, but you know that's that's sort of related to the inverse of the Hessian that you're actually worth a try. But it's also a filtering operation. Mm-hmm.
We tried the Hessian not actual Hessian, but approximation because for the data misfit part, it was some part of this Hessian was calculated for 1D model and then used the same for the whole process of the inversion. And the first step here was very far.
It was just this approximation, or did you also have your regularization in that?
Both. The whole penalty function.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah. And the first step was just too far, and we need to do some scaling
there. Some damping or something.
Yeah, and it didn't work.
I just had a little damping.
Yeah. Okay.
It'll work.
I just wonder whether, in fact, starting in a half space is silly. You have data. I remember John Booker in the 2D world was saying you should start with stitched 1D ETMs to start with 2D.
Because you have
information, right?
I think it's useful to use whatever information you have. I think it's also useful to start from a half space. It's also interesting because that gives you some idea about what you know what information is in the data. I wouldn't say that you should just stop with that. But.
Yeah, these iterations are so expensive if you want to minimize them as few as possible.
I guess the comment that I might make in addition to this is that we find it's always very helpful to have a reference model into that reference function so that you're always writing whatever modeling dot m minus some m reference.
Yeah, what is the reference model?
Well, it's whatever you know. So it's your best starting half space. Sometimes you might know more, sometimes you might know less. So that's a way of kind of putting in that a priori.
Yeah, but for synthetic tests, what is it?
Well, again, you still have some idea. Like, if you've got a background half space, you could find the best fitting half space, for instance, and use that as a reference model.
Yeah, I understand, but for the synthetic tests, I know the solution. It can be my reference.
And there's a test for your algorithm. You can start at the solution and see what that algorithm is.
Yeah, I tried. I tried this, and it works. It doesn't go anywhere else, but...
But what that was saying is start your half space, you start from a 100 ohm meter half space or whatever, right?
Yeah.
You just a little damping, a little n minus n zero damping will help. That's all he's saying. It's
No, I just thought about this reference model. I never knew what to put in there. So. Okay. Yeah.
But, you know, it doesn't have to be, it's just a little something to help stabilize things. You rarely don't have any information like that. So you can look at the data in the real world, you can look at the data and like you say at high frequencies you get some idea of, well, the general resistivity is 10 ohm meters or 100 ohm meters. That's information. Mm-hmm. And you wouldn't start your model from your inversion from a model that was 1,000 ohm meters. So
I tried. No, it doesn't really improve. No. Yeah, one with four, it's a big difference, but three or five, it doesn't matter.
Yeah.